wrong sometimes, yeah, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again. We have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people in the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new. No baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future. Within hours or days, at least. That this will make a difference.
Prime Minister-designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop-and-search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Two times Prime Minister Najib Mikati has been given the task of forming a Lebanese cabinet for the third time. After officially being appointed by President Michel Aoun, Mikati stressed that he needs the confidence of the people, not only the lawmakers.
To stop the inferno, we all need to cooperate together. I know this is a difficult task, but I have my mind set. If I didn't have necessary foreign reassurances, I would have not taken this step.
While stressing openness to all factions, Mikati also noted that the new government will be formed, quote, according to the French initiative, for the interest of Lebanon and its economy. 72 members of parliament endorsed Mikati, including Hezbollah's loyalty to the resistance bloc.
Since the resignation of Hassan Diop's government in August 2020, the loyalty to resistance bloc has called for the formation of a government in order to facilitate the country's affairs. We have always dealt very positively with all the efforts, and with the emergence of signs pointing to the possible formation of a government, we have voted for Najib Mikati.
Experts believe the rhetoric with which Mikati has begun his task is that of openness, and therefore could pave the way for more flexible talks with all sides.
Prime Minister Mikati has clearly said he has foreign guarantees, and he also said there are no preconditions from any of the partners in the country. So this is a new method of dealing with things in Lebanon, would entail that all sides deal positively with this formation, since they all want a way out of the crisis in light of a looming security calamity if the crisis persists.
Mikati, who seems to have the support of the United States and France, has claimed he can stop the economic and financial collapse, which has worsened since October 2019. The designation of Najib Mikati as prime minister was calm and prompt. However, what lies ahead will be much more tumultuous, whether it is the formation process or facing the multifaceted crisis in Lebanon. Mariam Saleh from the Presidential Palace in Baabda.
people have been displaced from their homes after Taliban captured the Shia-dominated district of Malestan in central Ghazni province. They say the Taliban committed war crimes by killing tens of civilians.
We were in the region during the first two nights of the Taliban attack, but were forced to leave our homes. The Taliban forced us to provide them with food and drink. They also killed about 40 innocent civilians.
The recent Taliban advances across Afghanistan have brought heavy consequences for local Afghans, especially those who live in remote districts and villages. The Malestan in west of Ghazni province is one among attacked regions by the Taliban over the past weeks.
We call on the government to retake our district and secure the roads connecting Malestan to the provincial capital city of Ghazni. We, the people of Malestan, are the part of Afghan nation and the government is responsible to provide us the security.
Taliban has dismissed any reports on killing of civilians in the Malestan region. Fighting between the Taliban and Afghan government forces has increased over the past months as foreign troops leave the country. The Taliban has made rapid gains, retaking border crossings and rural areas. The government has stepped up operations to push back the militants. Figures show that at least 3,000 people have been displaced from Malestan district over the last 10 days following Taliban attacks there. Displaced residents say government forces did not resist those attacks as they had expected. This, as Afghan officials have repeatedly claimed that troops were tactically retreated from dozens of districts, including Malestan. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Israeli warplanes carried out airstrikes early Monday on positions in the Gaza Strip in response to incendiary balloons fired from Gaza. Palestinians say these balloons are a means to pressure the Israeli regime to respond to their demands and lift the siege imposed for 15 years, deteriorating the life of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Israeli airstrikes are part of efforts by Israel to undermine the Palestinian resilience and increase the suffering of Palestinians. These airstrikes show the weak position of the Israeli army. The Israeli regime is linking the reconstruction in Gaza to political issues, including the fate of its soldiers in Gaza, and we won't accept this. The ongoing blockade and restrictions will lead to serious consequences, and the resistance won't remain silent.
Among the demands, Palestinians call for the import of building materials required for the reconstruction of Gaza and the Qatari grant. Israel refuses all the Palestinian demands and links the reconstruction process in Gaza to political issues.
The Israeli regime has stopped the import of the required construction materials needed for factories that were damaged during the latest escalation. This has led to paralyzing the economy of Gaza. The Israeli regime thinks these attempts will break their willingness, but Palestinians will always support the resistance as the only means to defend their rights.
According to the Israeli army statement, the airstrike over Gaza won't stop as long as Palestinians keep firing incendiary balloons. Palestinian resistance expressed it's ready for all scenarios, including renewed fighting in the face of the Israeli inhumane acts.
The Israeli airstrikes reveal the true nature of the tension between Israeli regime and the Palestinian factions. There are many issues that need to be resolved, including reconstruction of Gaza. If Israeli regime keeps ignoring the Palestinian demands, we won't sit idle.
Palestinians here say the Israeli airstrike is an attempt to put pressure on resistant groups to give up on their demands. Palestinians also stress they will keep firing incendiary balloons until Israel lifts its crippling blockade and end restrictions imposed on the reconstruction of the war-ravaged Gaza. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Ten months ago, Israeli forces arrested Palestinian football player Jevara Namoura and held him behind bars without charge or trial under what's known as administrative detention, deemed illegal based on international law. 3 months later, his pregnant wife gave birth to their first child, a daughter named Julia. This month, his administrative detention order was supposed to end. However, the Israeli regime extended his illegal detention. Almost 2 weeks ago, Guevara started an open-ended hunger strike, protesting his illegal detention and hoping to see and cuddle his seven-month-old Julia. At least 14 other Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails are on hunger strike in protest of their unfair administrative detention without charge or trial. The Prisoners Affairs Commission revealed that Israeli prison authorities maltreated the hunger-striking detainees and had moved them to solitary confinement to force them in their protest. Israel uses the so-called administrative detention policy to arrest and hold Palestinians without filing formal charges. Tel Aviv insists that they were arrested on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners and their lawyers. Human rights groups say Israel should either prosecute those prisoners or release them, especially that the detention orders can be renewed indefinitely, and the detainees could even stay in prison up to 10 years. Israel holds some 5,000 Palestinians in its jails, including hundreds who are held behind bars without any charge or trial. For the Palestinian prisoners, the hunger strike is an attempt to expose Israel's illegal policy of administrative detention that must come to an end. Israel, however, continues to be intransigent in dealing with the hunger strikers' legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners would follow the same path in the future. Mona Kandil, West of Occupied Ramallah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Pegasus, an Israeli spy work, the malware for mobile phones, has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this? And what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on the Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet Number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates?
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and researcher Daniel Gunja out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Dan and Jill, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
The Pegasus spyware is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had also been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which of course creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being directed. It has its source in a Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as this being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad. The founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine, or the State of Israel, is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook. These are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices, as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who is in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world. It affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramiro just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states. As we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
It's dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have ties to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence and can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it so dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy, because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine, and in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to effectively coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
Right, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it? What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries, but it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com. So where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma, and I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has, this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there. And effectively, there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what the other guest said, it's of course also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure, and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces. But there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course, to remain aware of them.
Ramiro, why aren't we seeing more of a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also, some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this, using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity, because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms is so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors. And they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary. And that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal. The possibility of that side of things.
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have, and it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights. While at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced, digitalized entity, so I wouldn't be surprised if they have other software, so if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about that, Ramiro? Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. Just from the, we know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral. And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise, you can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us in my generation, especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Daniel Jedrick out of Barcelona and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
the limelight. Because the signs of U.S. capitalism's decline are denied or misunderstood, they lead individuals and groups often to resort to frustrated, misguided, and desperate acts. They are blind to the structural problem of an economic system no longer capable of dealing with its contradictions. We now present you an article written by Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. The piece is titled, Increasing Desperation as U.S. Capitalist System Declines. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Like all previous economic systems in recorded history, capitalism is on track to repeat the same three-step trip: birth, evolution, and death. The timing and other specifics of each system's trip differs. Births and evolutions are commonly experienced as positive, celebrated for their progress and promise. However, the declines and deaths are often denied and usually feel difficult and depressing. U.S. capitalism has reached and passed its peak. Like that of the British Empire after the First World War, the trip now is painful. Signs of decline accumulate. The last 40 years of slow economic growth in the United States have seen the top 10% take nearly all of it. The other 90% of the population suffered constricted real wage growth, and that drove them to borrow massively for homes, cars, credit cards, and college expenses. Of course, their creditors were mostly that same 10%. University costs rose as graduates' prospects for good jobs and incomes fell. Those without degrees faced worse prospects. Inequalities of wealth and income soared. To protect their position atop these inequalities, the 10% increased their donation-fueled sway over politics and culture. Compliant politicians then reinforced the deepening inequalities of wealth and income in that typical spiral of systems in decline. The U.S. response to COVID-19 displays more signs. With 4% of the world's population, the United States accounts for 20% of the world's COVID-19 deaths. Despite being a rich country with so-called well-developed medical apparatus, the system as a whole has failed to cope. Its response compares unfavorably with that of many less rich, less medically equipped nations. In the United States, testing, prevention, treatment, and vaccination remain uneven, inadequate, and slow. The United States has recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were neither necessary nor successful in military terms. They did enable massive government spending and justified rising defense outlays in federal budgets. Huge U.S. military spending also helped cause neglect of infrastructure maintenance. That has now become urgent. The old guns versus butter problem typically attends economic system declines. As the U.S. government tries desperately to manage the mushrooming costs of its foreign and domestic programs, it resorts to a modern version of the ancients' debasing of the coinage. The Federal Reserve System monetizes deficits in fast-growing magnitudes. Given unemployment, constricted wages, and excessive personal debt levels, the money creation does not flow into real investment, but rather into stock markets. Inflation there has thus been real, fueling ever-deepening wealth inequality. We get promises that money creation will never shift its focus onto goods and services, thereby provoking classic inflation. We get assurances that the U.S. Federal Reserve will register and control such an inflation if it threatens. Those promises and assurances aim to help prevent what those in charge know are terrifying possibilities. The 6th of January assault on the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. made a shocked nation more aware of how deep its social divisions have become and how its social cohesion has disintegrated. Those who attacked the Capitol building reacted to the decline of capitalism by desperate resistance. From an election result to political liberalism to multiculturalism and so on and so forth. Like Donald Trump, they tried to reverse capitalism's decline because their ideology precludes them from recognizing that decline. They reason otherwise. They blame and therefore seek to dismantle the government itself. Yet the US government, via the two-party oligopoly in the US politics, has single-mindedly supported US capitalism. The two political parties differ partly and only on how best to do that. As decline persists, despite the party's efforts to stop it, building frustration eventually boils over. Efforts become extreme and thereby worsen rather than solve the problem. Donald Trump's cabinet members often devoted themselves to destroying their respective departments. The January 6 attackers sought to destroy as well. Such self-destruction is a sign of advanced system decline. Throwing money now at the long-neglected U.S. infrastructure runs a risk of failure, parallel to what happened to U.S. foreign aid and many U.S. military adventures. The federal spending involved always goes either to private corporations for contracted goods and services, or else it goes to governments, foreign or domestic, local, regional, or national. The recipient governments likewise use them for contracts with private corporations. For example, large private corporations will carry out most of the work of U.S. infrastructure repair and updating. The contracted corporations will in turn use the money paid to them just as they use all their revenues from all of their other contracts. Some of the money will go to employees' wages and salaries, but much of it will go to all the other normal costs of doing business. These include high salaries for middle management and luxurious pay packages for upper management, machines for automation, relocating facilities from higher wage areas to lower wage areas to enhance profits, dividend increases for shareholders, interest on and repayment of corporate loans, and fees paid to outside consultants hired to help plan corporate growth, overseas investments, and defeating union drives. In short, federal spending will flow into corporate hands that will then reproduce the very system that neglected infrastructure and deepened income and wealth inequalities over recent decades. The system's decline is reproduced because its leaders cannot see the internal production structure of U.S. capitalism as a central problem, let alone to change it. U.S. factories, offices, and stores are nearly all divided into a dominant minority of owners and boards of directors versus a dominated majority of employees. That structure is deeply undemocratic. Employers are not accountable to employees. They use their position to enrich themselves relative to their employees, increasingly so over the last half century. The minority's unstable investment decisions, driven by irreducible uncertainty and what John Maynard Keynes, an English economist, called animal spirits, impose recurring, costly business cycles on society. The tensions and antagonisms between employers and employees upset and undermine physical and mental health and the vaunted efficiency of the system at every turn. Because the signs of U.S. capitalism's decline are denied or misunderstood, they lead individuals and groups often to resort to frustrated, misguided, and desperate acts. They are blind to the structural problem of an economic system no longer capable of dealing with its contradictions. Thus, the economic decline accelerates, like a train rushing down a track towards a stone wall. Most of its conductors and passengers either see no signs, or else note them, but without connecting them to their basic problem. Being on a moving train on track to hit a stone wall.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio.